Hello and welcome back to the second episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton, along with
Tristan Caracino, the non-Pelton half of the Fabulous Pelton Cast.
Which, as we explained, is not entirely because of the fact that I'm so egotistical to name this podcast only after myself. It's because he changed his name.
Just a little bit.
Not entirely, I said.
So on today's podcast, we'll be talking about wrapping up the Seattle sports weekend, which was very exciting. Definitely talking about the Seahawks win on Sunday, talking a little bit about the Huskies and the Sounders, tailgating, and then fantasy football.
That's the way the show goes.
It is, but that's what we'll be talking about today. First, I wanted to mention, I know we're not going to talk about TV very much, but I had to mention, I was watching Breaking Bad from this last week, which was absolutely harrowing. Probably it was a good TV show, but it was the worst piece of TV I've ever seen in my entire life.
See, that is not exactly convincing you that I should be watching Breaking Bad. I do not want my TV experience
If somebody would have come into the room and changed the channel to Franklin and Bash, I would have congratulated them. I was so desperate to watch Franklin and Bash while I was watching Breaking Bad. And they're like, my gut-wrenching the whole time. I feel like depressed. I've started hating myself at some point during the Breaking Bad episode. I can't imagine that happens during Franklin and Bash.
Well, that's who you are. Some people do hate themselves.
It's true. It seems like it's a fun jaunt, though.
You know what I watched last night? It was Brooklyn Nine-Nine, the premiere of
Ken
Tremendous program. It was solid.
It has Andy Samberg on it.
It does have Andy Samberg.
I have to say that looked absolutely terrible in the previews.
You know, it's a little weird because it's a cop show and a comedy, but, you know...
It's a cop to me.
It is. As Grantland pointed out in their analysis of this season's new comedies this year, like, if anyone knows how to make a show that is terrible for the first half season and then eventually gets really good, it is Michael Shore.
I always disagree that you're talking about Parks and Recreation.
And The Office.
I like the first, I wasn't watching The Office at the very beginning, so I rewatched that after it got good. But
see, I think you inject some of your thinking that it was good back into those first few episodes.
I liked Parks and Recreation immediately.
I was a little skeptical of Parks and Recreation.
I was such a big Aziz Ansari fan that literally anything Aziz Ansari was on, I would have thought was brilliant.
I mean, it's always clear the cast was great on that show, and it just kind of took a while to find its voice and its stride.
I was watching a clip the other week, a YouTube clip of him eating a really hot jalapeno, and he sings, "This is how you eat it." It's brilliant. It's brilliant stuff. Anyway, I digress. So let's start talking about the Seattle sports weekend. This weekend, the Sounders beat Real Salt Lake 2-0 to put them into first place in the MLS. We were at that match. Did you have any thoughts from...
Well, I thought it was one of the more impressive first halves we've seen from the Sounders. I mean, they completely controlled the run of the game against a Real Salt Lake team that came in first place in the Western Conference. You know, the Sounders have always had games in hand on RSL to try and make up that gap, but the fact that they've done it as quickly as they have by getting 3 points time and again in all these home games is pretty impressive. And then the interesting thing is that you still got Dempsey was on the bench for most of the game, came in, I think, at about the 65th minute, and Eddie Johnson came in a little bit later than that, but you had the two USA players on the bench, and the Sounders played as well as they did without getting much in terms of contributions from them.
Yeah, it was a lot of Obafemi Martins, and then also Andy Rose.
Played surprisingly well. I was a little stunned to see him in the starting lineup.
His cross that he had in for the Martins goal, it was pretty brilliant.
And then also Lamar Nagel continues to play really well, and that's where things get interesting. I wrote about this in the Seattle Times today. What do you do? How do you put all these players on the field together now that you've got Johnson and Dempsey back in the lineup? Can you start all of those guys? Probably not. So Lamar Nagel has probably been the Sounders' best, most consistent forward this season, but he's also the one who's not highly paid and not a national teamer. So who knows what happens there? That's going to be interesting to watch.
I think we've learned from the Seahawks that depth is the most important thing a professional sports team can have. It's probably a non-basketball professional sports team. Having depth and being able to rotate in and out Nagel and even potentially Rose with the three USA players, well, with Dempsey and Johnson, and then Martin's not a USA player. But being able to rotate everybody out keeps you at that consistent high level.
Yeah, especially because of the fact that they do have more games down the stretch than most MLS teams means that depth will probably be important. You're going to have a couple two-game weeks, but you know, I think at this point it would be a little bit of a disappointment if the Sounders don't finish top of table in the Western Conference.
Absolutely. And then so the Huskies this weekend headed to Soldier Field and beat Illinois, a pretty solid Illinois team, 34-24, in a game that really didn't feel that close.
No.
And then Bishop Sankey was really the deciding player in that Husky game. What were your thoughts on Bishop this weekend?
Over 200 yards for the second time in his last three games. He had that against Boise State in the Las Vegas Bowl. And he's really on kind of a run right now that's relatively unprecedented in Husky history. So you look at his last seven games, going back to the Cal game last year, which is when the run attack really started consistently pick up for the Huskies. He's rushed for 1,142 yards in those seven games. That's an average of 163 per game, which is insane. If you took those seven games and considered them a season, it would be the 10th best rushing season in Washington history. And if you go back actually a full season, take out the first two games last year, where San Diego State, Sankey didn't start, Callier started before he tore his ACL, and then the LSU game, where obviously not a lot of Huskies put up any good stats. Since then, over the last season, he's rushed for 1,726 yards. That would be the most in Husky history for a season, surpassing Corey Dillon in 1996, albeit he only had 12 games to play instead of 11. And then if you look at seven game stretches going back to that, Dillon and Napoleon Kaufman in 94 are the only guys in Husky history with better seven-game stretches.
Both second-round draft picks?
I think Kaufman might have been a first-round pick, but both definitely NFL picks. And then the last stat to throw out at you, this is a lot, this is why I put this at the bottom of the page so you can just review all these stats at your leisure. As far as I can tell, Sankey's first two games this year, 369 yards, most ever by a Husky running back in the first two games, surpassing Napoleon Kaufman, I believe, had 363 in 94.
So you were talking on Saturday about how you felt that Bishop Sankey should be considered a Heisman candidate, and I looked at ESPN. They do voting with the experts from ESPN, and he did not receive a vote. There were, I believe, 14 players who received votes. Bishop was not one of them, not discussed at any point. But I was thinking about it, and that conversation, it's not going to happen this week. No matter what happens against Idaho State, Bishop Sankey could run for 700 yards against Idaho State. Well, that would be pretty exciting.
I think they would come up if you ran for 700 yards.
But it's not going to happen against Idaho State. It's probably not going to happen against Arizona.
I think it could happen against Arizona.
The 2 weeks that we have to be targeting are Stanford and Oregon, at Stanford hosting Oregon. If Bishop Sankey can run in those games, even if the Huskies lose, but still gains 175 yards, something in that range, I think he'll definitely get consideration as a Heisman candidate.
Yeah, I mean, and that's where you're going up against, you know, Stanford doesn't really have a Heisman candidate, but Oregon, obviously, in theory, DeAnthony Thomas could. Mariota is right in that conversation right now. So that's part of what you're testing it yourself against other guys who are in that conversation. And then it's also games that the nation has its eye on. And that's where the one thing, I think, if the Huskies go to 4-0, if they could beat Arizona and beat Idaho State this weekend, then I think they'll be on knocking on the door of the top 10, and they'll be a team that people will be watching. So
it'll be a huge game, Stanford. If we win those two, going at Stanford,
the Arizona game is going to be a big game. It's going to be a matchup of two undefeated teams. That the Huskies and Arizona have just kind of always been about the same point in the conference. There was a lot of years where they were at the top of the conference in the early 90s, and then both went through a really rough patch in the early 2000s, and Arizona kind of got out of it faster than UW did. But now they're again at kind of that same point where whoever wins that game, it could be a springboard to competing against the Oregons and the Stanfords at this conference.
It's going to be an exciting game. I think that, I mean, we can talk about this later, but if they win those two games, if they can beat Arizona, beat Idaho State, I think they would be top 10 in that range, right around 10 through 12. Stanford, assumedly, would be top 5. In that range. It would probably be the biggest Husky football game since 2001.
Yeah, I would have to think so. Maybe 2002 when they played Michigan coming off of...
I feel like it's the Purdue Rose Bowl in Tui's last game. So let's hope that happens.
Anything else to take from that UW-Illinois game?
Nothing too much. I thought the defense looked really good. We're not going to glean a lot from this weekend. So the Husky conversation is really going to start kind of before and after that Arizona game. That's when we'll really be able to see what this team is.
A couple of interesting things, you know, the fact that they went to a lineup with four defensive ends, or basically three defensive ends and a linebacker in pass rush situations with Illinois was very successful. Josh Shirley had three sacks in the first half. That was a big part of the Huskies' defense, really, providing them the lead in the first half before the offense got going after halftime. So that's something to watch. And then the other thing is ASJ's return to the lineup had three catches for like 18 yards. Again, not a huge day for Kaysen Williams. He had the one nice catch on a jump ball that Keith Price kind of threw up, knowing that Kaysen was most likely to come down with that. But it continues to be the other guys who are doing a lot of damage. Kevin Smith had a big game on Saturday. Ross, Mickens, there's so many weapons at this point.
Absolutely. So then we turn to the granddaddy of them all. Seahawks 29, San Francisco 3 on Sunday night. And what most were considering the greatest Seahawks game since the 2006 playoffs.
Yeah.
There's a lot to take from this. but we'll start with Richard Sherman and Anquan Boldin. We talked last week about how Sherman wasn't following around Steve Smith. This week, it was announced that he was following around Anquan Boldin, and basically, he shut down Boldin completely. One catch for 6 yards,
seven
I think.
Yards, and it was not on Sherman. It was one of the rare plays when they weren't matched up. So
he had an interception of a pretty terrible Colin Kaepernick pass. Right when Kaepernick threw it, I yelled pick. And it was a pretty obvious interception. Sherman absolutely shut down Anquan Boldin.
Deservedly NFC Defensive Player of the Week this week.
I saw that, so it made me think, I was like, why don't we have Sherman follow whoever the top receivers from every team going forward? And I guess still, once you have Sherman and Browner, it probably doesn't make any sense. It makes more sense to have them follow that side of the field and to become completely specialized in that side of the field.
If you're more comfortable on one side of the field or not, but obviously Sherman showed that it doesn't matter to him.
It really doesn't.
But I think it may depend on the opponent. Because what made it such a great fit for last weekend is the fact that Anquan Boldin is so much more dangerous than any other San Francisco receiver, number one. And number two, the fact that he's such a physical receiver that, I mean, Browner would match up well with that. He's even more physical in some ways than Sherman is. But the fact that he plays that style made it really a situation where the Seahawks could completely take him out of what he likes to do.
It was interesting. The Pete Carroll show on Monday morning, he was saying that he was really excited when the 49ers traded for Anquan Boldin. He's like, I thought that was a great move for us because we match up against him so well.
That is a great Pete Carroll
comment. It was an awesome thing from Pete Carroll. But the other thing I was thinking about, basically, I was like, this is Richard Sherman's Defensive Player of the Year season. Like, we should cherish this time. I don't know if we've ever seen a defensive player, maybe since Cortez Kennedy, be this elite. But then I was kind
of... Wait, Cortez Kennedy won Defensive Player of the Year on the team that went 2-14.
It's true. That's what I'm saying, since Cortez Kennedy. But I also had to check myself. This is Anquan Boldin. He wasn't defending Calvin Johnson. It's not like a year ago, if Anquan Boldin doesn't have 200 yards in week one, our perception about him is vastly different. He's somebody who's over 30 years old. He's not like an elite receiver at this point. It's not like Sherman was shutting down Calvin Johnson, Andre Johnson, Larry Fitzgerald.
That's true, but at the same time, the 49ers are a known very good offensive team. They did go to the Super Bowl last year, and they had 3 points.
No, it was obviously an amazing defensive performance. So let's talk a little bit about how they kind of allowed Colin Kaepernick to get some separation running, but basically stop the pass completely.
Well, it's the opposite of the Green Bay game plan from the week before, which, you know, I think we all expected based on the way the Packers got torched by Kaepernick in the read option in the playoff game. And they spent the next entire offseason, the next 8 months, preparing for the read option. And then all of a sudden the 49ers come out and, you know, they still ran the read option, but almost always handed it off. Kaepernick barely ran, and he throws for 400 yards against a team that has sold out basically against the run. So the Seahawks were able to, you know, I don't think that they sold out against the pass in the same way that the Packers sold out against the run, but just they were able to play a much more balanced style and stop both in many ways.
And let Colin Kaepernick run at times. We weren't so consumed with stopping the run and hitting Colin Kaepernick that it meant that we had to sell out completely and leave somebody like Anquan Boldin wide open. Also, having a player like Richard Sherman completely changes your defensive game plan. Where if you can have the best corner in the NFL flanking Anquan Boldin, they're just not going to get that much traction.
And then the other thing that we saw was the play of the Seahawks' new defensive ends. Cliff Avril making his debut, Michael Bennett playing a much larger role than he did coming back from injury in week one. And they dominated the San Francisco offensive line, which is very surprising because that's considered unanimously the best offensive line in the NFL.
Absolutely. And another player who looked really good, played the second most snaps of anybody on defense, was D'Anthony Smith, who they just traded for from the Jaguars.
That's interesting. I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah, I was looking at the snap counts yesterday. Avril played the most snaps, or no, Bennett played the most snaps, and then D'Anthony Smith played the second most snaps the entire game.
And the Seahawks were very stout against the inside run Frank Gore, who has been a problem for them in the past, most notably last year at San Francisco when he had, I think, 131 yards in that low-scoring game. So that was a big difference from past San Francisco-Seattle matchups.
And talking about rushing up the middle, so I was looking at Pro Football Reference, thinking that was kind of the most interesting way to look at the game after the game, statistically speaking. There wasn't a lot to be taken from it, but the Seahawks running up the middle really dominated running up the middle and could not run to any other direction. Up the middle, they had 10 carries for 62 yards and 2 touchdowns. Of that, Marshawn Lynch had 7 carries for 51 yards and 2 touchdowns. It was really the only place that Marshawn got much separation. And I had to wonder, was the early injury to nose tackle Ian Williams, he broke his ankle on an early play, do you feel like that affected running up the middle?
I think potentially it did. I mean, you look at those numbers. That should, again, be a strength of San Francisco. They've got Patrick Willis and Navarro Bowman as their inside linebackers, arguably the best duo, probably is the best duo of inside linebackers in the league. So, you know, that's not a place you expect to have a lot of success. I think also that's where the read option threat helped the Seahawks a little bit. Even though Alden Smith was generally crashing down, it still slowed things down just enough that it gave Marshawn Lynch an ability to run inside.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, running against Bowman and Willis and having your biggest success there is pretty amazing. But it does show that Justin Smith and Alden Smith on the sides is such a threat, and they completely shut down any running to the outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't run at Alden Smith anymore. Chris Collinsworth had a good point about that during the game. He did a terrific job. There was a lot of negative yardage plays when they tried to go to the outside. And Marshawn Lynch needs to stop running backwards. That's not a good idea.
That also might have to do with Russell Okung's injury, too, pretty early on in the game.
Yeah. Although that, I think, helped the Seahawks run up the middle because James Carpenter did a terrific job as a run blocker.
I also thought it was interesting. I was looking through the snap counts. Jermaine Kearse, who was the hero of week one, had 26 offensive snaps, which is about half of the snaps, and did not get a target the entire game.
Yeah, I think he was in there primarily because of the fact that he has emerged as a really good blocker at that wide receiver position. You know, he's done a good job blocking downfield at times we've seen, and then even on simple run plays, does a nice job. And I think that's a lot of why they had him in the game. And then you also have to honor that deep threat that he's shown.
It makes Jermaine Kearse so much more of a dynamic player, where if we can have him in, and it's going to indicate run to most teams. But then he catches the long touchdown in week one, and having threats in both different aspects.
Yeah, that's where you eventually hit that play action and potentially come up with a big play for him once San Francisco brings that second safety up.
But not a lot of targets for any of the receivers. One target for Doug Baldwin, who we talked about last week, having a lot of chemistry with Russell Wilson. He had one target, which is a 51-yard catch, which is a pretty good target. I believe 3 targets for Golden Tate, 5 for Sidney Rice, and just 1 catch. And 2 targets, I think, for Zach Miller.
Yeah, the Sidney Rice one was a little disconcerting. He had some catchable balls that he didn't come down with. But also, you know, a lot of it, I think, was caused by the offensive line with Paul McQuiston out there at left tackle trying to block Alden Smith and not having a lot of success of it. Russell Wilson was on the run all day and just wasn't in sync. He hit the big plays, but didn't have that kind of rhythm we usually see from him.
And I was looking back at this. It was definitely the worst game of Colin Kaepernick's career in the NFL. And probably the worst game for Russell Wilson. Interesting that they both had that, but that the Seahawks dominated the game so much.
And that's where the difference in the running games comes through. But, I don't know if I thought it was his worst game, because I thought, you know, he did a nice job hitting the big plays when they were open and, you know, avoided really negative plays. The one interception they had was a case where Golden Tate fell down. Nothing Russell could do about that, really, so He managed the game surprisingly well for someone who completed less than 50% of his passes.
It was a very un-Russell Wilson-like game.
Very much.
Really. It was not the high completion percentage, big chunk of yards game that he had in week one. I also wanted to mention, after being at the game, so Sean Alexander raised the 12th man flag.
Well, we should talk a little bit about the experience of being at the game, because, I mean, first off, the decibel record and the crowd.
It was definitely the loudest I've ever heard CenturyLink Quest Field. It was definitely loud. It was kind of shocking how much louder it was for this game than it was for the 49ers last year.
That is shocking to me.
It was noticeably louder. I think it was probably because people were focused on the loudness, trying to set the decibel record. We kind of thought there would be a time where they were like, cheer as loud as possible, but it was basically just measuring throughout the game how loud it was, which I actually kind of thought was interesting. It meant that we stayed as loud as possible every single play. It was definitely the loudest. Maybe that Marshawn Lynch run, the Beastquake, against New Orleans in the playoffs, but really this I remember being much louder.
But like the sustained noise as opposed to just that one.
Every single play. Every single defensive play.
Let's talk about the lightning delay that lasted for an hour.
It was weird. So it was so loud, I did not hear a referee one time. You couldn't hear their mics at all. So we didn't really know what was going on. You could kind of tell because all the players were running off the field.
Yeah, that seems like an obvious camera.
And it seemed fairly obvious. You could kind of maybe see a lightning strike, but couldn't really tell what was going on until we went into the corridor and could watch the NBC broadcast. So it took us a few minutes. We didn't know how long it would last for. I was getting text messages letting me know how long the delay would last for.
And it's a case where those of us who were at home were much more informed than everyone at the game. And in my case, like, I knew the lightning delay was coming because I could hear a lot of thunder here, and, you know, less than 10 miles south of
the
stadium.
We saw a couple flashes, but you can't even really hear thunder. It is so loud there all the time.
Constant thunder.
What wasn't loud was Sean Alexander when he raised the 12th man flag. It is crazy how uninspiring Sean Alexander is. I was sitting there, and I looked over, and I saw it was going to be Sean Alexander there, like, 2000 first-round draft pick. I thought there was a chance that it would be somebody from the 2005 team. And people just do not feel positive feelings about Sean Alexander.
Technically, he is one of the more accomplished players in Seahawks history, I feel like everyone has come around to my point of view on this issue.
It's really crazy. Sean Alexander, he has to be, like, one of the least liked players. That whole team, honestly, except for probably Walter Jones... Walter Jones, Max Strong, and Mike Holmgren.
I would say Hasselbeck. I would put him
And Hass, to a certain extent, probably less. Walter Jones is the guy from that team.
Yeah, weird how an offensive lineman, like, it's correct, because Walt Jones should have been the MVP in the league in 2005. It should not have been Sean Alexander.
It's actually pretty brilliant. But Sean Alexander, it inspires so little from Seahawks fans. Every single second, it was as loud as can be, except for Sean Alexander raising the 12th man flag. I was like, oh, let's just get this over with.
I like that Grantland's Robert Mays wrote about this weekend, about the Seahawks and them becoming the coolest team in the NFL, and he even noted how little people seem to care about Sean Alexander.
It's really crazy. He definitely is the team MVP, probably for any team in the league, that inspires the least.
Yeah, I mean, he was the NFL MVP, so...
I was like, where's Macklemore? I was like, they just wanted somebody else, anybody else. It could have been Hersey Hawkins out there, and people would have been way more excited.
I mean, it's weird. If he's gone long enough, like, out of sight, out of mind, will he become more popular?
Not a chance.
Huh. Okay, so
his popularity is low, and that's where it's staying. And it's just a personality thing.
What if he gets in the Hall of Fame?
I don't know. First off, I don't see him getting into the Hall of Fame.
It's unlikely. Walt Jones probably should get in. Probably should be first ballot.
Walt Jones would definitely be first ballot. But I don't see Sean Alexander getting in. Even then, I don't feel like we're going to claim Sean Alexander in that same way. I wonder if it's because we're in the Seattle area. It's not a heavy religious town. And Sean Alexander was going so hard on the Christianity during his time period here.
He was.
That I feel like he might have put off a big part of that fan base.
I don't know. I mean... You know, there are other guys who have maybe not been
Aaron Curry.
Well, there are other guys that are definitely religious, maybe not quite as in your face. I mean, like, Russell Wilson's obviously very religious. Not is in your face, but he definitely, like, that's a part of who he is. But I think it's just the fact that Sean Alexander has always seemed fake.
Yeah, and never really seemed like that great of a running back either, kind of on his own merits.
Well, he was a very good running back, but it's just running backs aren't that important, and his success was more a testament to how good that offensive line was, especially on that left side with Jones and Steve Hutchinson.
But it was an electric atmosphere the whole time. It was easily the best Seahawks game I've ever been to, and the most exciting Seahawks game I've ever been to. Definitely looking forward to it throughout the season and really hoping for a playoff game, because I was thinking about the opportunities for it to get louder than it was, for us to break the current record that CenturyLink Field holds decibel-wise. And I was like, yeah, the Monday night game against New Orleans, there's a possibility there depending on how they look. But a playoff game, particularly an NFC championship game, it would be the loudest anybody's ever. It'd be deafening.
It would be pretty incredible. I think we should talk about, so we've gone through the weekend. Sounders win first place on Friday. Saturday, Huskies win. Also, the Seattle Storm won in Tina Thompson's
final, oh, really?
Final regular season.
4-0.
And Sunday, the Seahawks win. So where does that rank? I guess among the best Seattle sports weekends ever. Is that the best?
So I feel like it has to be. In my memory, it was easily the best Seattle sports weekend. Obviously, my memory hopefully stretches longer than 5 days. I did some research on some times that could have been better. So last year in 2012, we had the Monday night, the Fail Mary game against the Packers. And then the following Thursday night, this wasn't technically the same week, the following Thursday night, the Huskies beat Stanford at home. It still didn't quite feel as exciting as this did. The Fail Mary kind of had a bit of, had some feelings all wrapped up in it.
It was kind of belittled by
the fact that every single national news outlet said that we shouldn't have won the game didn't make it feel quite as good. And there was kind of a lingering feeling of that we won it on this last play, which was questionable. So there was that game. The Sounders also in that same week beat Marathon in the CONCACAF Champions League. It was not like this, though, honestly.
I think it was 3 days back-to-back-to-back really is a big factor in it.
And I recall, so we watched, this was in 2009.
No.
The Sounders played their first ever match and won their first ever match, which was pretty exciting.
3-0, right?
And also, the Husky men's basketball team beat Mississippi State in the first round of the NCAA tournament. And that was a pretty exciting day that happened in the same day. And we were able to watch UW versus Mississippi State and then go directly to the most important soccer moment in Seattle history, all on that same day. But what I remember as being the greatest sports day of my entire life, it doesn't really add up to this weekend in any way. But that was January 22nd, 2006. So it was a Sunday. During the day, the Seahawks beat the Panthers to go to the Super Bowl, which at the time was probably the biggest win in Seahawks history. Probably still is.
It's still the biggest win in Seahawks history.
It didn't feel quite as exciting as it does now, but that's probably because it's now.
Well, also because we know that they didn't win the Super Bowl.
Well, yeah, that's true.
At that point, it was a major realistic possibility.
Seemed like when they went to the Super Bowl, there was a chance.
Right. Like 50-50 or something.
And then later that day, the Sonics beat the Suns like 153 to 146.
151-149 in double overtime on a Ray Allen three-pointer.
Ray Allen hit the super long three. It was amazing. And then after that, Kobe Bryant scored 81 points.
That was pretty incredible because it was just one in succession after the other after the other. I mean, I remember flipping back and forth between the NFC Championship game and the start of that Sonics game. And then like it's afterwards, like that you find out, oh, hey, Kobe Bryant has a bunch of points. We better put this game on League Pass, which is something, one of those games that would have been so much different, days that would have been so much different in the Twitter era because people would have just been going crazy about everything.
Yeah, that was a pretty amazing day. But it still doesn't equal this. I mean, the Sonics win, it was a really exciting win, but it didn't mean anything. I think it took them to 16 and 24.
Yeah, they also had a horrible loss on Friday night, 2 days before that, at home.
So that was not quite as exciting. I feel like this has to be the greatest sports weekend in Seattle history.
The good thing is now that we have this podcast, we can mark this as the greatest, and if anything surpasses it, we'll be here to tell.
Yeah, this year.
Well, I'm assuming this podcast is going on ad infinitum.
So. I mean, I agree, but
I mean, we have literally 24 listeners.
I feel like that had to be the greatest sports weekend. We're riding such a high. The national news also has picked up on in such a way that I've never seen before. Where the Seahawks are being written about by every single publication. The Huskies aren't getting much action just yet. But
they're on the highlights now as a top 25 team. That's one of the things about being in the top 25, despite how dismissive you are of that concept.
And people are including Oregon in there too, which obviously we're not as excited about because we're talking Seattle sports.
Oh, Wazoo also won this weekend.
It was pretty amazing all around. I feel like every single team that I was cheering for, it was a big win for the Fabulous Pelton cast in the weekend.
Amazing timing to start just before this weekend.
But so let's talk about tailgating. We talked about this a lot last week. It was probably the thing that we had the most response from was tailgating over the weekend.
Yeah.
Particularly pumpkin beer, which we'll talk about in a second.
We will.
People have feelings about pumpkin beer.
People are feeling things about pumpkin beer.
Which is really surprising. Maybe it's the time of year. I don't know. But so the beer that we went with, we were talking about it, and we settled probably on Sierra Nevada Tumbler, which I did not purchase. We went with, and this felt like fate, it felt like we had to get it. I saw it. They had 12 packs. They have the milk carton caps, which I really like. But that was the Hilliard's 12th can pale ale. Hilliard's is a local brewery from Ballard. They're pretty good. They've been supportive. I like Hilliard's generally. I have to give the review of the beer is not great.
I don't feel like I can give a review of it because I drank it after it was like after a day of tailgating and then having drank the night before, and it was too much at that point.
It's just not a smooth beer. Like, you have to compare it to like Ninkasi's Total Domination, which is a really smooth drink, and Manny's Pale Ale, which is just like, it's like drinking gold when you drink Manny's. Especially because you're only getting Manny's out of the tap too, yeah. So that's making it even better. But it was not. I will not be drinking it again.
Really, I think it's got to be a tradition.
Drinking the 12th can.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Maybe not multiple ones every weekend, but
we have to mix it up every single weekend, right? We have to spread it around with a new thing for all, at least 8 weekends.
What if you drink it every week on the way into the stadium? Is the final thing you drink?
It's not a good final drink.
It's sour.
It's a better first beer than it is a last beer. I drank the pumpkin ale, which we can talk about.
Friday afternoon, the weather was supposed to clear up and get sunny and be in the high 70s, and it didn't. It stayed gray all day.
That's pretty bad.
So I'm very upset at the weathercasters, but it meant it officially was time for fall beer.
Yeah, it's definitely fall.
So when I went to make my purchase on Friday night, I got the pumpkin beer from
Elysian Night Owl.
Yeah.
And it was really good. I have to say, my feelings about pumpkin beer have changed 180.
Wow, that was fast.
Yeah.
I mean, I went from drinking sour beer to fall beer in two days. So.
It took literally one day for you to switch from summer to fall. But it was really good. It had the right amount of spice. It didn't taste like pumpkin, really, was the issue.
Yeah, it's not overwhelming.
You don't really want to taste the pumpkin. You just want to taste pumpkin spice.
Yeah.
Pumpkin is not a good thing to eat. When it tastes too much like pumpkin, that's not good.
I agree.
And that's what I was saying about the Pumpking. Got a lot of recommendations for pumpkin beer and people being excited about it. It seems to be that Elysian makes the best pumpkin beer, though.
That's quite possible.
And they make two different pumpkin beers. I actually Googled best pumpkin beer, and Elysian came up in there. They have a second pumpkin beer, which came up as one of the better ones. But this weekend, so we've got two tailgates coming up this weekend. The Huskies play at home, and the Seahawks play at home. Both 1 p.m. starts.
Noon start for the Huskies.
Oh, wow. Jeez, that's really early.
That is really early.
So they're both going to be early tailgates, a little bit shorter. But I do feel like this has to be the Tumblr weekend.
Yeah, without question.
At least Saturday, we'll definitely do Tumblr. We'll see how it goes and see if we want to do it again on Sunday. But I'm ready. I'm ready to drink that. I think Fremont Ale has a fall beer that we could potentially try on Sunday. But it's time for a fall beer, I know.
The calendar and the weather has dictated, even though it's sunny as we're taping this, it's in the 60s, it's hoodie weather, it's no longer summer.
It was cold. I woke up cold today.
Yeah.
I was not feeling like warm when I woke up. And then also for the burgers, so we talked about the Juicy Lucy, decided not to do it, I think at your recommendation.
I believe that was the conclusion we came to on the podcast.
But I don't know if that was a good recommendation, because the burgers, they were fine. It was basically just burger, cheese, bun. There's nothing else there.
I thought the cheese was really well melted.
You thought the cheese was well melted?
It really made it appetizing.
Did it?
Yeah. I had two of them. I don't know if you guys ate the second burger until you went in.
We did not.
Yeah.
The cheese was melted fine. I just need more, right? It's not a gourmet burger when it's just bun and cheese and burger.
No. One of our listeners, Nick, who works with me, text in to say that as long as you get high enough quality ground beef, you don't really have to worry too much about food poisoning from the undercooked burger.
Well, there we go. Yeah. We have high enough quality ground beef. Get food poisoning. Just don't even worry about cooking it.
He did not advise you to get raw. That was not part of the
high enough quality. Well, we're not getting high enough quality ground beef. This is ground beef from Grocery Outlet.
Well,
the nickname for Grocery Outlet is Gross Out.
That's your nickname.
There are multiple people who use that nickname. But this weekend, so for I think for both, we just need to bring the accoutrement. You need tomato. You don't eat tomato personally, but tomato has to be there for a premium burger. Tomato, lettuce, homemade guacamole, which we will definitely have on Saturday.
That's a big one.
And then I personally, so we've had mustard and ketchup, but I love the ketchup mayonnaise mixture. Putting those two together, it's like eating gold.
secret sauce. Well, yeah. First off, you're drinking gold and you're eating gold.
It's perfect. If you can drink and eat gold at the same time.
I find gold kind of hard to eat.
Not me. But we need all the other things. So tomato, lettuce, guacamole, and then the mayonnaise and ketchup mixture.
Secret sauce.
Secret sauce.
Yeah.
To put it all together to have a really great burger. And I kind of like the short tailgates where you're there, you get set up, and then you're eaten right away. At the game on Sunday, we probably waited 5 hours before we started barbecuing. I mean, we got there at 10 a.m. and barbecued at probably 3 p.m.
Something like that, yeah. And the opening tailgate at UW season against Boise State, we were there for, I think, six hours probably before
and
we ate.
It was also 2,000 degrees outside.
That it also was. So it'll be a very different experience. The week after next, Arizona will be a 4 p.m. start. That, to me, is ideal.
Yeah, that's the perfect tailgate time. You have a canopy. It's in the fall. Like, really, a fall tailgate is the best tailgate.
Now, the one thing that I want to know if we should consider is the post-gate on Saturday, since it's a noon kickoff.
I feel like you're so exhausted after a football game, after getting there at 10 a.m., because we'll probably get there at 10 a.m., drinking and eating for 3 hours.
But we're not going to eat there. Drink.
I guess we're only going to drink and eat for 2 hours.
By definition, we're not.
I don't know. The postgate is never a good idea, though.
Someday I'm going to make this happen.
It's a recipe for disaster. I wanted to, when we beat USC for the first time, I wanted to postgate really badly. But that really just meant that I wanted to drink more. I was just ready to drink more because I was excited for the game. So I'm going to say no postgating.
Someday it's going to happen.
But this weekend, we're going to have much better tailgates. We're going to do Tumblr and then something else. We'll have something good to review, too, on Sunday. Something special. And it'll be better than the Hilliard's 12th can. I have to say, I love their branding. I think it looks really nice. But the taste is not there yet.
All right. Well, good effort. Good job, good effort, Hilliard's.
Anyway, so we turn to fantasy football. You and I both advanced to 2-0. Advanced. We both went to 2-0 this weekend.
We're worried about getting relegated this weekend.
Yeah. Any thoughts from the weekend?
I was pretty excited about my team, which tied for the most points in the league, despite having Colin Kaepernick give me a 4 against that Seahawks
defense. Yeah, Russell Wilson had a 10, our quarterbacks, Russell Wilson and Colin Kaepernick. Russell Wilson had a 10 and Colin Kaepernick with a 4, and Russell really got it because of that pass touchdown that Marshawn Lynch literally walked in backwards.
He literally did. It was a nice day for Marshawn Lynch, who had a 30 for me, kind of bounced back for week one.
Yeah, it kind of felt like the running backs, who some had some slow weeks in week one, returned to form. And a lot of running backs with big yards. Doug Martin had 140 yards, but no touchdown. Yep. LeSean McCoy had 170 yards, but no touchdown. C.J. Spiller with 120 and no touchdown. So big yardage, but no touchdowns. It really makes your game seem less exciting, but I would expect in the future that they'll turn itself around.
I think that might have been part of why the scores were kind of low throughout the league.
The one thing that I would note is David Wilson really still did not look good. He didn't fumble, but he just didn't look good running the ball. I think it's probably in his head so much that I don't know if I see David Wilson really becoming a worthwhile fantasy player all season.
I mean, maybe eventually, but I think at this point, yeah, he's probably running much more conservatively than normal and too conservatively.
And then Stephen Ridley, I think he had a 4 in fantasy. He's somebody, if I was a Stephen Ridley owner, I would be very concerned right now.
I am a Stephen Ridley owner, and I am very concerned right now. Despite my excitement about Giovanni Bernard coming up with 17 on Monday night, he's not ready to play yet as my number 2 running back.
There are some of those running backs who, the like second-tier running backs, so Jacquizz Rodgers moves to be a starter this week with Steven Jackson being injured. Not a starter fantasy-wise, I don't think.
What about Snelling?
Snelling's still going to be like a fullback-type position. I mean, he had 2 carries last week. I think he had just 1 touchdown, so it made it seem like a better game. Than he had. Rodgers was the starting running back, or was the lead rusher for them after Steven Jackson got hurt. And also Noshon Moreno, who's somebody who really had a breakout game coming. He basically shared the amount of snaps. He had maybe 3 more snaps than Monte Ball had, though.
But he ended up with a lot more yardage out of it.
Tons more yardage, more points. It was a much better game. The breakdown from wide receivers and running backs stayed pretty consistent. There were 25 wide receivers who put up 10-plus points this week. And it was a pretty impressive amount.
Well, I think that gets to, you know, one of the things we've been talking about offline is that running back wide receiver flex position. At this point, I think it's become more of a default third wide receiver than third running back. And I know that's the case with my team. I have way more depth at wide out.
And I think there are a lot of teams like that. On the waiver wire, there are a few wide receivers that are interesting if you're looking to move to that but don't have the personnel for it. And then there's also the running back, James Starks. James Starks is the obvious waiver claim. If you have the top waiver claim, he's the obvious pick for that. He was second in all of fantasy in points this week. Do you think that... So James Starks, clearly the starter for Green Bay with Eddie Lacy injured. Do you think that Jonathan Franklin, the other running back in Green Bay, is worth a flyer?
No, and I am considerably more skeptical about James Starks than you are. I think that it's their first 100-yard rushing game in, what, like 2.5 seasons?
And you don't think he's the obvious waiver claim this week?
No, I don't think so at all.
Who do you think is the
I don't know that I think there is an obvious waiver claim this week, but I just... I don't count on much production from James Starks going forward. We've seen this play before. Like, he was there last year. It's not without Eddie Lacy and Jonathan Franklin.
If you were to sign James Starks this week, would you play him? How many weeks do you think it would take you to?
It would take me at least one more week to really be comfortable. I mean, I might play him because of the fact that my second running back options are not great right now. I'm starting Ryan Matthews this week.
But I definitely do think that third position is looking like a wide receiver position. So did you have any waiver claims that you would advise for this week?
Oh, well, I wouldn't advise them because other people in the league are still listening to this podcast. But I have three waiver claims in at two different positions.
Do you? I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you.
You're not going to say who it is. It's Martellus Bennett. That's who.
Maybe it isn't.
So I was thinking about some of the waiver claims. Eddie Royal is another big waiver claim for this week. And I'll tell you, I am not excited about Eddie Royal.
So you feel about Eddie Royal like I feel about James Starks.
James Starks had the yardage, though. So Eddie Royal, in his first 2 weeks, has 5 touchdowns and just 114 yards. And it's being swayed so much by the touchdowns. You just cannot count on touchdowns going forward.
They're not predictable, no.
And with Martellus Bennett, he had the yardage there. Martellus Bennett had 70 yards and a touchdown this week. James Starks with 132 yards on 20 carries and a touchdown.
A week after 0-4-0.
Well, that was when Eddie Lacy was the starter.
Well, Eddie Lacy could play this weekend. It's not inconceivable that he's going to play this weekend.
I think James Starks has taken the job and run with it. It is James Starks' job right now.
We'll see.
But so there was another waiver wide receiver who I was interested in, and that was DeAndre Hopkins.
Yeah.
The Houston Texans wide receiver is their first-round draft pick this year, I believe out of Clemson. And so he's playing across from Andre Johnson, who's banged up. DeAndre Hopkins this week had 117 yards and a touchdown in the overtime game that the Texans and the Titans played. He seems like a great pick to me.
Part of that, I think, was the DeAndre Johnson effect, obviously. But, he had 66 yards the first week playing with Johnson. So he's shown he can be viable even if he's the number two wideout for the Texans. And as a young guy, he's got a lot of upside. So I do like that. If I wasn't in a situation where I have so much depth at wide receiver right now that...
I think that DeAndre Hopkins is going to emerge into a top wide receiver. I think he's going to be a top 20 wide receiver this year.
I have a hard time seeing him as more than a flex play.
And he had 13 targets this last week, which is great. You love to see that. And the yardage and a touchdown. It's everything that you would be looking for. Plus, he's a young wide receiver, highly skilled. He's going to be taking... Andre Johnson's always going to take some attention away from him, or he's going to be the number one target. He's in kind of a perfect position, as far as I can tell. DeAndre Hopkins is somebody who... I hope I get. I have a claim in for him, and I hope that I get him. I am happy to drop Kenny Britt. Kenny Britt is kind of who DeAndre Hopkins was 2 years ago, except he kept getting injured.
Well, I should ask you this fantasy question. Mr. Fantasy Expert here.
Yeah.
I have Lance Moore, who last year was a 1,000-yard receiver. And so far, through two games, has 3 catches for, I believe, like 50 yards. Should I be dropping him?
Absolutely. They're basically New Orleans wide receivers. If you don't have Jimmy Graham, obviously a tight end, or Marcus Colston, none of them are worth owning. I would never trust a New Orleans wide receiver. They spread the ball around too much. Some people were talking about signing Kenny Stills, the rookie out of Texas.
Bill Simmons, notably.
I don't think that any New Orleans wide receiver can be counted on except for Marcus Colston, who is their clear number one target. Jimmy Graham, who's their clear red zone target.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And the other thing is, if he's at the end of your bench, like there's not upside unless
exactly.
Colston gets hurt. Even
exactly.
Still, it's going to be a high committee.
If you have a player on your bench who's going to inconsistently score between 5 and maybe 13 points, You have no reason to have them on your team. You're never going to start them. Think about how many people have to get injured for you to feel comfortable starting Lance Moore.
It's like the situation with Reggie Bush a few years ago where I had him on my team the entire season. He never started one game.
I mean, there are a lot of players like that where you have to think, okay, if one person gets injured, then they're going to be elite. Ben Tate is somebody who, if Arian Foster gets hurt, he's going to be an elite running back.
I look at Bryce Brown that way.
Bryce Brown is another player like that, where if LeSean McCoy gets hurt, he's going to be one of the top 10 running backs. But if you have a player who they need three players to get injured, that's what I was kind of thinking about Christian Michael when there was excitement about, and that was a question that we had from one of the listeners this week, was, is Christian Michael worth owning? And I was saying, he's the third string running back. He doesn't have a carry all season. And he's also, I mean, he would need both Robert Turbin and Marshawn Lynch to get injured to really be a viable fantasy running back.
I mean, it's possible that if just Marshawn Lynch got injured, he could take the job from Robert Turbin. But yeah, I agree with you that it's not until or unless Marshawn Lynch gets injured, knock on wood, that he would even be worth considering.
And so there are a lot of players out there like that where you basically are just like, you're going to have them on your team, but you're never going to start them. And those are players that I always try to avoid. I always want players who are one player away, really, really skilled players who just need the one player in front of them to get hurt. Or just need the one player in front of them to get suspended. The one player in front of them to not be playing anymore.
That's the case, maybe.
That's what you want. You don't want a player like Lance Moore who needs five people to get hurt to really get the kind of action that he's going to need. And even still, the Saints are going to spread it around no matter who they have. They have you a wide receiver, they'd spread it around you.
I don't think I would get very many passes. I don't think I'd be good at creating separation.
But DeAndre Hopkins is somebody who I could clearly see starting by the end of the season. I would even consider, if Andre Johnson is out this week, I would consider starting him this week over Lamar Miller and Reggie Wayne.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Do you? I feel like that's a crazy thing that I just said. I just said I would start him over Lamar Miller and Reggie Wayne.
I mean, Lamar Miller...
I've gone too far on DeAndre Hopkins.
Lamar Miller's been inconsistent. I mean, Reggie Wayne is what? Like, he's a solid 10, you know, every week.
I have a question for you, which is, if you had the first pick in the draft right now after 2 weeks of fantasy, would you draft... I'm going to give you two options. You can list a third option. These are the two that seem like the obvious ones to me. Would you draft LeSean McCoy or Adrian Peterson? Adrian Peterson is the clear favorite going into the draft. LeSean McCoy has been the best running back in the NFL this season.
I think I would probably draft LeSean McCoy. I think the one worry I would have is I think that he's probably going to get injured at some point this season based on his workload and his size. You disagree?
I'm hoping not.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we just talked about Marshawn Lynch getting injured. I hope not for several reasons.
So that's your only concern?
That's my biggest concern.
I would absolutely make that same pick. If I had the first pick in the draft, I don't feel like I would draft Adrian Peterson for another till pick six, in that range. He may turn it on again mid season like he did last year, but there's just nothing else there in Minnesota.
Ponder had a nice game on Sunday.
Ponder did pick it up.
Yeah,
picked it up a little bit. But I would still draft Doug Martin. I would still draft Jamal Charles. I would probably still draft C.J. Spiller over him.
All right. Well, we'll see about that.
I would not draft Arian Foster.
Yeah, we do know that.
And so we close from a question from one of our loyal listeners.
Well, we actually have two pieces of listener feedback.
Oh, okay.
Which the first recall was last week we talked about what a mistake it was by our cousin Katie to drop Vic Ballard in our league. And literally at the same time we were taping, more or less, the Colts were practicing and Vic Ballard was tearing his ACL and is out for the season, unfortunately, which rendered useless a conversation we had afterwards where Katie claimed that she had Jermaine Kearse on her bench, the Seahawks wide receiver that we talked about earlier, who is owned in 1% of ESPN leagues, as opposed to Vic Ballard was owned in 100% of ESPN fantasy leagues. She claimed that Jermaine Kearse was going to outscore Vic Ballard this season. We were looking forward to tracking that all year.
I was very excited. I actually had a dream that night that Vic Ballard scored 2 touchdowns and had 67 yards. That's one of the saddest bits of information that I've ever shared.
It really is. Probably so too personal.
Dreaming about Vic Ballard. But I was excited. I was really excited to have this comparison.
So his final tally is 6 points for the season. Jermaine Kearse stuck on 10 as he was last week. Did not catch a pass.
Jermaine Kearse without a target.
He is going to unquestionably beat Vic Ballard, barring a lot of fumbles.
It's going to get real ugly for Jermaine Kearse. But Jermaine Kearse is one of those situations where if we have to be serious, which we don't because it's Jermaine Kearse, but for Jermaine Kearse to be starting, I was saying that I wouldn't start a single Seahawks wide receiver right
Golden
now.
Golden Tate is not a good
if
start right
Golden
now.
Tate, if Sidney Rice, if Doug Baldwin all got hurt, I still would not start Jermaine Kearse in fantasy. But anyway.
Yeah, yeah, that's probably accurate.
People have feelings. And so now we close from a question from a loyal listener.
Kristen Duvall.
Do you want to read that?
Yeah. Was the insane production from the tight end position in week one a blip on the radar or a sign of the change in the style of offensive play in the NFL? I think there were... Oh, that's not part of the question.
So the listener, Kristen Duvall, is asking, was the production from the tight end position a change of style in the NFL, or was it just a random blip? And that was in week one. After week two, I think that there was less production from the tight end position.
Definitely.
Pretty significantly less. So week one, the production that happened was a lot of two-touchdown games from tight ends. We had 5 two-touchdown games from tight ends in week one and 2 two-touchdown games in week two. So I think that with the tight end position, basically you're not counting on yards. You have Jimmy Graham who will get yards. You have Rob Gronkowski who will get yards. And that's pretty much it. You're counting on, do they score a touchdown or not? And so with the 5 tight ends scoring touchdowns in week 1, 2 in week 2, it's going to be like that all season. It'll be between 2 and 5. Some players are going to score a lot of touchdowns, some aren't. It's going to be a heavier passing league, which is why the wide receivers are kind of dominating. And that is a bit of a change stylistically in the NFL, but I don't think that teams are going to be throwing to tight ends more.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't seen too many teams copy what the Patriots tried to do with the double tight end look. Cincinnati is the exception to that, who's using a lot of 2 tight ends with Eifert and Jermaine Gresham.
And to be able to have 2 viable fantasy tight ends, you got to be scoring a lot of points.
Yeah, and they're not. So, I think that the one guy who really stood out is maintaining his week 1 performance with Jordan Cameron, who had, I think, 90 yards receiving last Sunday. Although it'll be interesting to see how Josh Gordon's return maybe cuts into that.
Anything else on fantasy?
I think that pretty much is it.
Awesome. So that wraps up week 2.
Yeah, two more in the books.
Thank you. We'll be back next week with more talk about the Seahawks, the Huskies, fantasy football, and beer.